Hello everyone, I'm Harry Bucknell. Thank you for downloading this podcast from The Oldie. My guest for this month's interview with Friends of The Oldie is the highly talented Lloyd Grossman, who possesses an enviable gift to turn his hand to anything and hit the wicket first ball. In this month's edition of the magazine, the 399th, no less, he writes about that doyen of 18th century carving, Grinling Gibbons. But in this programme, we talk about pretty much everything else, from punk to the summer of love to Rousseau, but not Voltaire. Our discussion, however, starts in a South London garden in November 1983 with Lloyd talking to a large black rabbit. I hope you enjoy the programme. In November 1983, you were in a garden in South Norwood talking to a large black rabbit. And this was for one of the earlier editions of Through the Keyhole. And I know this because I've seen it on television. So anyway, there you are. And the question you never asked this punk rock star was, what on earth was he doing with the black rabbit in the first place? It's very un-rock and roll, don't you think?
I know, I don't, I can say with some honesty, I have absolutely no recollection of that at all.
Well, I'm afraid, if you go onto YouTube, it's all there in black and white. Well, actually it wasn't in Technicolor then, but it was, of course, Captain Sensible, who was you know,
Oh, Captain Sensible, now that all, yes.
Ian Dury wouldn't be seen dead with a black rabbit, would he?
Well, one doesn't really know. I mean, you know, Ian was a great sort of artist in, you know, both as a sort of artsy type artist and as a pop artist. I think he would love to be seen with a black rabbit. And, you know, Captain Sensible had a definite role in British pop culture. I'm very pleased to say I like his work a lot, actually. But I don't remember him dressed as a black rabbit. He was afraid.
You know, the black rabbit was dressed as a black rabbit, not him.
See.
It's a real one. But the thing was this, is that, of course, for a punk rocker, really, Captain Sensible, I mean, he had a hit with Happy Talkie Talkie from the South Pacific. I mean, how does that figure?
Because I think, wasn't Captain Sensible originally the bass player in either The Damned or The Clash?
The Damned.
The Damned. So he had gone from being a sort of fairly hardcore punk to, you know, going mainstream. And, you know, I agree. I mean, Happy Talk, whilst I loved it in South Pacific, I have to say the Captain Sensible's version of it was never my favourite. But, you know, I thought he was quite a cool guy.
It might not have been your favourite, but it was certainly the nation's favourite. I mean, you know, he did quite well with it, didn't he, really? You know,
He did very well with it, and I was absolutely thrilled.
But as a punk rocker, he wasn't really of the genre, was he? I mean, he turned up on that ITV show in black tie, looking quite.
Yes, but I think you could probably, because, you know, in a sort of postmodern way, but basically you can excuse almost anything by just saying it was ironic.
Well, there's plenty of that. I mean, that I'm not trying to cast words. There's plenty of irony in your own career. You could say we are all images of irony. But I'd just like to say, because you started off, you were born in Boston, Massachusetts, and your father, David, was an antique dealer. But interestingly enough, how was it meeting your cousin? Must have been a very interesting fellow, Ram Dass. What was that like, having him? Because I think he said that I didn't have one whiff of God until I took psychedelics. I mean, that must be made for an interesting... The cousin coming for lunch, Ram Dass for lunch, must have made for a very interesting Sunday lunch, didn't it?
Well, Ram Dass was an extraordinary man. You know, great, formidably intelligent. A great sort of pioneer of the whole hippie movement and the, you know, expanding consciousness movement, et cetera, et cetera. Quite sort of, you know, unusual in our family and, you know, somewhat puzzling. But for me as a sort of teenager, it was really terrific when he wrote his book, Be Here Now, which was once described as the hippie Bible. You know, it was quite a sort of, it was the sort of thing that we teenagers wanted to read, you know, in what was then known as the Summer of Love, you know, 1967-68. You know, being having Ram Dass as a family member was a bit like, you know, having Rousseau or Sartre or Bertrand Russell sitting around the table.
Yeah, but not Voltaire.
Oh, no, not quite Voltaire. But Voltaire has very few equals.
But he looked, I mean, he does look, he looks to be the most wonderful fun to have been around. I mean, it's sort of enormous sort of Oliver Reed type teddy bear sort of fellow. I mean, he must have been very sort of, just a very sort of spiritual and loving person, wasn't he?
Yes, yeah. I mean, full of fun, actually, very, very witty, but as I say, very spiritual, very intelligent. An interesting part of the family, but, you know, the family was interesting. He just added a bit more spice to it, because mostly the family were, I was going to say, appeared to be conventional, but like most families weren't. Mm-hmm.
Behind the scenes, it's all smoke and mirrors. I know what you mean, but was it your father's sort of, you know, his business and so on that gave you this essentially at the heart of Lloyd Grossman lies this great understanding of the arts and culture and heritage? Did that come from your father?
Well, my father, rather like me, was quite a sort of, I don't know, conflicted, but conflicted sounds rather negative. Was a person drawn in many different directions, because he'd had quite a successful and interesting career as a jazz musician before he was drawn into the family business to sell 18th century art and antiques. And he gave me my love. I mean, fortunately, both my mother and father were very musical. My mother was a much more skillful musician. My father was a much more intuitive musician, but they both gave me a great love of music, which I've always pursued. And my father imbued me with a huge interest in history and architecture and painting, etc., etc., etc. So, yeah, like everyone else, I think a lot of the interests that I've pursued through life have come to me through my parents. For someone who was, you know, a hippie and then a punk, I was the most terrible rebel. And I remember my I got tickets. I had tickets to Woodstock, and I told my mother I was going to Woodstock, and she said, absolutely not. And so I was probably the only member of the acid generation who was not only prevented from going to Woodstock by his mother, but actually went along with it.
That may have been your doing, actually, because presumably had you gone, you might have then fried your brain on psychedelics, and that would be the end of that. Through the keyhole would never happen. Why did you want to come to Britain? In that, was it because of the fact that did you feel that was a sort of bridge to Europe that gave you the gateway to the sort of the true sort of, I mean, say the true arts, the great heritage and history that we have here on this side, which you have, of course, in the States, but not to the same extent, perhaps. What was the draw to Britain?
It wasn't a Henry Jamesian type thing. I mean, I had, you know, after I'd left university, I had spent a few years as a very unsuccessful musician. And one of my sort of mentors from university said to me, look, I think your real career should be as an academic. And I said, yes, maybe you're right, because I'm not a good enough guitarist. And he said, yeah, well, I think what you should do is go off to England, get a master's degree, and then come back here to the States to do a PhD. So I said, all right, that sounds interesting. And so that's why I went off to England, just, you know, intending to be here for a year, just to get my master's degree, and then to go back and do a PhD in the States, and then have a career in the States, you know, wearing a corduroy jacket, teaching undergraduates, I suppose.
Now, can I just ask, at what point did you realize that your career in music was over? Because you haven't quite given that up yet. Was it the third Fender Stratocaster you smashed to bits on the stage, or the second chicken whose head you bit off? Or was it just the fact that there was no money in the till when you came to leave the bar at the end of the night?
No, I mean, I think, you know, I've always, I mean, thankfully, I mean, ever since I was about 14 years old, I've always been in a band and played in a band, which I absolutely love. But I think probably when I was in my mid-20s, I just sort of thought that it really, you know, I was probably not going to make a major contribution to the history of pop music. I think that's probably the best way of putting it.
Very modest.
And I was on, there was a very famous band in America called, a huge, huge band called Sly and the Family Stone.
Oh, yeah.
And my band were playing as the opening act for him at a couple of concerts. And it was so utterly miserable, and we were so extraordinarily bad that I thought, actually, I think it's probably now time to turn my hand elsewhere.
I mean, you do. I mean, you are being very modest because you have played at Glastonbury 8 times.
Yes, I have. I mean,
so you are hiding the Grossman light under the bushel somewhat.
Maybe somewhat, but not. I'm trying to think of what the opposite of somewhat is.
I didn't. But we are digressing. We need to crack on. So, it's going to be a long interview. So. But you say, you know, after you left university, but you did go to 3 universities.
Yes, I did. Yeah.
So which university? So you from Boston, you then came across to Magdalen and then LSE. And
I went to LSE first and then to Cambridge.
Was one degree seems to do most people.
Yeah, I just, I like learning things. I like learning things. I'm always learning something. And I'm better at learning in kind of a structured way than just sort of sitting at home teaching myself Urdu or whatever. You know, I need a bit of a structure. So that's why, you know, I've had a sort of a rather long university career. And I like the atmosphere of universities.
You know, I can appreciate that. I went to Harris, so I can look at all these things and with wonder, but I didn't really know much about it. But after university, you then went on to start your career in journalism, which was sort of running alongside at the same time. And you know, I say you went to LSE, London School of Economics. So how come you end up as the design editor of Harper's and Queen, when surely you're good at designing spreadsheets, if they had them in those days?
Well, because I had started, I had begun writing stuff, you know, being a journalist when I was in my teens, doing a lot of stuff for the so-called underground press, which in those days included what was then a startup magazine called Rolling Stone, which of course became one of the most famous publications in the world. So I was very lucky to write quite a lot for Rolling Stone in the early days and do a lot of music journalism. So when I was in London, and I'd always had a great interest in architecture and furniture, et cetera, et cetera. So when I was in London, I mean, I started contributing to Harper's and Queen as a freelance. And it was very exciting because at that time, Harper's and Queen was the most unbelievably trendy, glossy magazine in the world. I mean, it was fantastic. And there were a lot of really, you know, fantastic people working there. Nick Coleridge, for example, Craig Brown, et cetera. And, you know, so there was a very good team of young journalists. And for some reason, because I'd been a contributor, I was then asked to join Harper's as a staff member. And, you know, and that was that. And the rest is history.
And of course, in those days, presumably you were then in Hanover Square, in that great office block in Hanover Square, were you?
No, we were in Harper's and Queen was in Broadwick Street in Soho. Hanover Square was Condé Nast.
Yes. Age is playing games with my mind again, Lloyd. but of course, it must have been quite a collegiate atmosphere. I mean, you're all there, and it must have been quite a sort of social occasion going to work, was it?
It was great fun. I mean, we were all, you know, great friends. It was great fun, and it was in the days when we had a wonderful editor called Willie Landall. Scots. He was just brilliant. He was half Scottish, Presbyterian and half Venetian. And, you know, 5 o'clock every Friday afternoon, bottles of champagne would be opened to celebrate the end of the week, you know, all that sort of thing. It was a bit like one of those sort of sitcoms about glossy magazines. You know, it was all frightfully glamorous, very good fun. We had the most, we had the best time just writing about all sorts of rather strange and interesting things. And it was a wonderful experience and wonderful training. I mean, I wrote so much stuff in those days. There was one issue where I was, I think I had to write under two or three different pseudonyms because I'd written so much of it. And it was great. It was really great training with fascinating people. Willie was the most brilliant ever there. And yeah, and Peter York was there. You know, it was that scene. It was brilliant. It was fascinating.
And of course, this was the time when newspapers were selling because people, that was, there was no internet and magazines sold, and there was an appetite for them. And so it was boom, boom, boom. When you talked, you mentioned already how life was very exciting. You know, when you were in Boston at the time of the end of the 60s, you know, with Woodstock and Vietnam, looking back, they seem exciting, but I suppose at the time they were quite hairy. Then you come to London. After LSE, you were reasonably expected to go home. What made you really stay? What started the love affair with Great Britain?
Well, I had a girlfriend. So that encouraged one to stay. And, you know, I think I very much liked, I mean, Boston was very kind of Anglophile society anyway. So I had, you know, I had a lot of friends here in London, and it was just such a wonderful city, such a fabulous place. And I enjoyed England so much that, you know, I don't know, that was 46 years ago.
And you've never looked back. It sounds, again, I've made this point already, that it sounds slightly glib, but did you feel that you were at the heart of the heritage sort of historical path, as it were, in terms of, you know, this is where it all began, sort of thing. And then being slightly sort of shallow about the whole thing, and because America was great artistic foundation.
Yes,
and that's not to decry it.
No, I don't think I never explicitly sort of felt, oh gosh, this is where it's at, sort of thing. I just knew that it was a beautiful country with very nice values and interesting people, and you know,
you're very kind.
I never did. I'm not very good. I didn't plan anything. I never plan anything.
Because the interesting thing is that if you look at your career, and you've got a career in journalism, a career in food, a career in music, but actually, secretly, the pillars that it seems to be sort of founded on now are all about heritage and the arts and so on, and that everything around it probably has enabled you to have that sort of heritage foundation. But actually, everything around it was sort of nice to have, and of course, you talk about exciting. And again, working with David Frost on Through the Keyhole, it must have been, like working with David Frost, one of the great giants of television, giants of journalism today. What was he like?
I had a great time with David, and I mean it was particularly interesting for me because I knew nothing about television. When I was recruited to work for TVAM, I knew absolutely zero about television, other than, you know, things that I had watched. And suddenly to be working very closely with, you know, the guy who at that stage, I think he was probably the most famous broadcaster in the world at that stage. And so it was quite an extraordinary leap to go from nothing and ignorant to go to be working very closely with, you know, the world's best broadcaster. We had a terrific time together. You know, David was extraordinarily generous, which a lot of stars aren't. You know, one of the things that one notices about showbiz is that there is quite often a big difference between people's public persona and the way they behave. And I sometimes found that, you know, really, really quite shocking. But David was so generous and amiable and just a very nice person. And it's kind of odd to, for someone with such sort of colossal ambition, which he obviously did have, which led to his help with his great success, for someone like that to be so, so humorous and sharing, you know, and just a really terrific person to work with. And there was no reason at all why he, you know, should have been so sort of nice and helpful to me. But he was, you know, I was lucky to land up, you know, through no skill of my own. I was very lucky to end up working with him so closely for 20 some odd years.
Yeah, I mean, it comes across, Lloyd, that you too share his wonderful personality, but do you have this split personality off screen? Will you shout down the telephone line at the editor after this and say, get that bum off the air, and I find my license has been revoked and the whole thing has been scrapped? I mean, just asking, I'll put it out there now. but of course, for 10 years, also you presented MasterChef. I must confess, call me a bluff, it's a specious programme. I can't cook for toffee, you know, Lloyd. And there's everybody doing these wonderful things with peas and frost and stuff. And I'm lucky if I can make a fish finger, frankly, and thaw itself out. And see, this is not, I mean, did you enjoy that? I mean, it must have been quite testing at times.
But it was fun because it was a very, look, it was very innovative programme. And for someone, I mean, I have always had a great love of food and a great interest in food. And I've never pretended to be someone who, you know, knows a great deal about cooking, but I certainly know a heck of a lot about eating because I've been a very enthusiastic eater for my entire life. You know, I was lucky as a child. At a period when, you know, when most children did not go to restaurants, I was always being taken to restaurants by my parents, even, you know, when I was little. So that was great. So I've always just loved food and loved the history of food and the culture of food, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. And, you know, so MasterChef was just a wonderful program to do because suddenly I could spend so much time talking, you know, talking about food.
And you see, You do sort of look a bit like Paul Newman. So you took him on his own game and had your own sauce brand made, didn't you?
You look
a bit like Paul Newman, don't you?
I think that's remarkably flattering, but I look nothing at all.
I'm worried about the split personality kicking in, that's why. So
what I really enjoyed about MasterChef in particular was that it was kind of making food, good food, into entertainment, and it was making good food into, it was sort of, if there is such a word, it was sort of de-snobifying it.
Well, you're talking to the wrong person here about that. Like, I just eat the stuff. But I'm with you all the way. But it was a very exciting time too, because you had all those, you had Keith Floyd was knocking around just about then still. You had the two fat ladies, all the sort of different chefs coming up, and cooking was sort of taking off. And in the same way, I suppose, that went through the keyhole when you're working for TVAM, no one ever thought that breakfast TV would take off then, did they?
No. And, you know, and I remember when breakfast TV was first mooted, you know, which I guess was in, I think, 1982, people were saying, oh, that's such a trashy idea. That's really awful. I mean, we're not going to be as bad as the Americans, are we? It's just terrible. How can we contemplate that? No one will watch television in the morning. You know, of course, totally untrue, and all became hugely
successful. World headlines.
And you know, with MasterChef, they had been, previously there were some quite good food programs. You know, and there was the food and drink show, et cetera, et cetera.
Fanny Craddock, Lloyd.
Oh, Fanny Craddock. Well, even way before then, Philip Harbin, etc.
Galloping Gourmet.
But the Galloping Gourmet, who I loved. I thought Graham Carr was brilliant. But, you know, through MasterChef really changed the whole, the way in which food programs were perceived by, I don't know, by just being much more populist, I think, and not necessarily, not aimed at people who were already interested in cooking, but aimed at people who could really appreciate that food and cookery could bring something more interesting and more entertaining to their lives.
But also, I suppose, at the same time as that, in the 90s, Britain was booming in a way that it will probably never boom again in our lifetime, certainly. But therefore, there was much more the culture of restaurants were taking off in their own way. Aubergine the bread that swears, and all those great restaurants around London were sort of taking off. And it was a very exciting time to be doing food anyway, wasn't it? The food was the marble of its day. Had you been a Roman?
You know, and television, of course, goes in waves of enthusiasm. So, you know, we had a particular period where television was really most interested in snooker, for example. Now, you don't see very much snooker on television, do you? But you see a lot more cooking. Then you got to the period where, you know, a lot of sort of property porn was on television. Everyone wanted to do property programs. Yeah. Now it's everyone wants to do competition.
Here's what I found.
So it's, you know, television goes in waves, and Through the Keyhole and MasterChef were both important part of waves of television. Whether they created the waves or whether they just caught them at the beginning, you know, who knows?
Well, every loved the Through the Keyhole because, of course, it was... a chance to snoop on someone else's house. Goodness gracious me, look at that. Whose soap is that? And I think there's a sort of version which is slightly coming back now, isn't there, with a sort of, where you go into someone's house. I've just seen a sort of series of trailer for it, actually. But do you think you'd be allowed to do Through the Keyhole in the same way now? Because it's slightly intrusive, slightly...
Probably not, because, of course... Through the Keyhole started in 1983, and that was also just around the time when all of those celebrity lifestyle magazines were starting. Maybe it was just before that. So in a way, because every celebrity is showing off their house in every magazine and color supplement all the time, the original premise of Through the Keyhole would not be as kind of exciting and different as it was back in those days.
I never forget a friend of mine whose name shall remain nameless, but they were famous polo playing dynasties, as I seem to call. He lived in a cottage, shall we say, somewhere in Gloucestershire, but the cottage inside wasn't grand enough. So when Hello came to shoot on him, he had the picture taken on the porch and then he went to someone else's house for the inside. So that's how it was in those days. I'm just going to, we've touched briefly on your career as a musician. You actually, in 1977, reached number 47 in the singles chart with Ain't Doing Nothing, which is really a bit of a misnomer. It's an oxymoron, really, because you've never stopped doing everything. And yet you've got this song, which was number 47. There you are, dissing poor old Captain Sensible. You got number 47, you know, with your punk band Jet Bronx, and then later now the Forbidden with my old school chum Valentine Guinness.
Valentine, my long time collaborator.
Lots of noise, lots of energy. It is very different from the Lloyd Grossman that we know, who has been as a former commissioner of English Heritage and has sat on the board of Museums and Galleries Commission. What is the joy for you about punk music and about heavy rock?
Well, it's fun. It's fun. It's fun. And, well, you know how you always enjoy doing something that you can actually do? So, you know, I can do it. So therefore, I really like doing it. And, you know, for someone of my generation where, you know, music, popular music was just what defined us as a culture and as a generation, not being involved in music is kind of inconceivable to me. So, you know, I just, I have to be involved with music. And since I'm able to make music to some extent, I will carry on doing that, no matter what the audience thinks.
But they obviously like it. I see that big bushel coming up again and the light being shoved under it. I mean, you know, we talk about music today, and I've been recently converted to Radio Boom, which plays Baby Boomer's music, and it's great music. And someone said, oh, you all dance around the kitchen all breakfast, and dance around the kitchen I do mostly. Our listeners at the Oldie Podcast will love this, but is it the case that music today simply doesn't seem to have, it must have for the generations behind us, and there are many now. For me, there's no signature tune that says this is 2021. If there is a signature tune, it's probably something that goes back from the Three Degrees or something from the 1970s or whatever. And it does seem a bit strange that I'm sure that the music doesn't seem to be made in the same way as it used to be.
What I think is quite interesting is that because of the ability to download music and to get music over the internet, the historical development of music is slightly put to one side. So, for example, my children very happily listen to early Rolling Stones music or Chuck Berry, or, you know, there's no popular music has lost its sense of history. And I think that's actually a fabulous thing. So you get kids now, you know, and children much younger than mine, you get 16, 17, 18-year-old kids listening to early Rolling Stones, listening to Prince, listening to James Brown. And, you know, it is all wonderful the way that all of popular music is out there as this great stew that's just going to be sampled by anyone.
Who do you think is the Elvis Presley of today?
I don't think there has ever been an Elvis Presley of any time other than Elvis himself.
You see, that's what 3 degrees, you see. That's what happens if you get educated on top of a hill. Now, in the current issue of the Oldie, you've written a very erudite article on Grinley Gibbons, partly because you are on the board of Compton Burney Art Gallery in Warwickshire. And, of course, there is this very exciting exhibition of centuries in the making at Bonhams in August this year, and then at Compton Burney in September, of the great works of Grinley and Gibbons. What for you is the attraction? I mean, the master craftsman, this 18th century Dutchman who came across to Britain to ply his trade, what for you is this sort of the attraction to Gibbons and his work?
Okay, well, although firstly I have to say that I have finished my term at Compton Burney, so I'm no longer on the board there. But Compton Burney is quite an extraordinary place. It's absolutely wonderful. Well, Gibbons, Grinley Gibbons appeals to me greatly and has always appealed to me because of his extraordinary skill. See, I love wood. And he, you know, probably the greatest wood carver of the 18th century, maybe the greatest wood carver ever. And there is something also, even though he, you know, was born in the Low Countries, but of British ancestry, there's something extraordinarily English about his work, the way he finds his inspiration in nature, his beautiful carvings of flowers, the way he takes them and turns them into decorative motifs. He's, you know, he is one of the great artists stroke craftsmen of his century. And to me, it's very important to realize how important craft is. You know, craft is not just the sort of little brother or little sister of art. Craft and art, to me, go hand in hand. And celebrating his birthday is a great chance to really celebrate British craftsmanship, both past and present.
Of course, I suppose that it is hardly surprising you would say that, because you were number two at the Royal School of Drawing, set up by the Prince of Wales. And of course, one of the great champions of craftsmanship is the Prince of Wales himself today, and rightly so, because I always think if you look at buildings, the detail on a building, on a modern building today, will be lost. Because if you look up at an 18th century, even a 19th century building, the detail on the buildings up above on the first, second, and third floors is what makes the building. And we need to bring that back. And I think it's a great sadness. But of course, as we look at Grinley Gibbons' work now, and all that lime water, of course, is now faded and turned brown. In its day, it would have been almost pristine white, wouldn't it?
And that lime wood is the most wonderful material because of the precision with which it can be carved. And when you see it, it is remarkable because when you look at it in situ, the way it contributes to the whole feeling of a room is fantastic. But then when you examine it just on its own as an individual masterpiece, it repays endless attention. And it's always inspirational to see someone do something really well. And it doesn't matter whether it's, I am not particularly interested in football, but when I see, a world-class footballer playing, I think, gosh, that is fantastic. And, to see any skill brought to the highest possible level is absolutely inspirational.
I couldn't agree more there. And it's humbling too, often.
Really?
But I suppose in France, of course, they have these great guilds and so on, and they protect their artisans at great length. And I don't suppose, although we have, and you are actually a member of all manner of worshipful companies of carpenters and so on and so forth, and I know, but and they are the trade bodies, effectively, that still, the goldsmiths and so on, that still control and look after the goldsmiths trade and the apprentices coming through, and it's very, very important. But do you think there's anything we can do to sort of tighten up, further protect, and also nurture our artisan community?
Yeah, we have, there are a number of historic crafts that are down to a tiny handful of practitioners in this country. And I think it's very important that we should really look back into our history, really identify the things that we've done well and always do well. I mean, for example, the other day, I found the most wonderful trug maker, someone who makes the most beautiful trugs in England, which, is an amazing bit of artistry and craftsmanship, but also an incredible expression of our history and culture. And, I think we should really try harder to find the people who are making beautiful, wonderful, traditional things and support them, because they've got to earn a living. They need, they need patrons. They need patrons. Yeah. And, it's no longer, they can no longer depend on these great sort of ducal households to provide them with huge amounts of work. We, the boring members of the bourgeoisie, have to step up and, start supporting craftsmanship and artistry.
Now, although I got it wrong about your involvement with Compton Burning House Trust, you are still president of what was formerly known as NADFAS, the Arts Society. And that, of course, is another wonderful organisation that promotes the arts and so on around the country with all sorts of interesting talks and so on. You are also, where Donald Trump failed, you have now been elected for your third term as chairman of the Royal Parks. And this is remarkable.
Now, I've been appointed for my second term as chairman of the Royal Parks.
All right. Okay, you win. Well, that's still more than Donald Trump. Now, anyway, is there some other celebrity or some retired MP lying dead in a bush somewhere in Hyde Park that we don't know about? I mean, what occasioned this wonderful renaissance? Yet again, Lloyd rules the world. I mean, there you are. Last month on the Oldie podcast, we had Hunter Davis, and he's just written a book about walking through the parks of London.
Yes, he's a great man.
We promoted his book about the parks and so on, and it was just coming out, I think, next year. So we should have had you together. You could have knocked points, obviously, because he always reckoned he knew where all the park keepers were and so on. But recently, this last year, London's parks have come under huge pressure because of the amount of use they've had, which they wouldn't otherwise perhaps have had. What is the state of our parks currently? I mean, it's one of London's great, great assets, the parks.
There are all sorts of different parks and they are under different sorts of pressure. I think local authority parks are particularly stressed at the moment because of the funding issues with local authorities. The Royal Parks are, of course, very different because of our history and our status and so on. I mean, we are fortunate, you know, the Royal Parks, we have 5,000 acres of the most important landscape in the greatest city in the world. And that's a huge privilege. Even before lockdown, we were entertaining and inspiring an enormous number of visitors. I mean, we get, you know, in an average year, we get nearly 80 million visitors a year. So that's twice as many visitors as Disney World and Disneyland put together. I mean, we are, you know, one of the world's greatest visitor attractions. And throughout the lockdown, we have even more visitors because, of course, rather sadly, so many people in London don't have any access to high quality outdoor space. So the pressures on the park have been very significant. You know, when you look at a park, it's, you know, unsurprisingly, most people think, well, you know, a park, what you have to do to keep it up is you've got to pick up the litter and mow the lawns. It's much more complicated than that because, of course, when you get millions and millions of visitors, they wear out the paths. They do a lot of, they compact the soil and that damages the tree roots, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. So managing these tens of millions of visitors and protecting the natural environment, the important landscapes, the sites of special scientific interest, at a time when our normal commercial activities couldn't be carried on, has been an extraordinary challenge over the last year. But I have to say, you know, with huge thanks to my colleagues and my staff, we have never closed. We have never closed. We were absolutely determined. The parks were going to remain open every day. Because I think Londoners would have had a collective nervous breakdown without us. So I'm really proud of the job we've done in staying open and keeping the parks looking more beautiful than any urban parks on earth.
And presumably, from your point of view, it is a thankless task because you're constantly fighting for further votes of budgets and so on, and to keep the thing not only just ticking over, but also it has to be improved. It is a constantly evolving body of land, isn't it, of course?
I mean, you know, the first Royal Park, which is Greenwich, dates back to the mid-15th century, and Duke Humphrey, who was Henry V's brother. You know, so we have a very, very long pedigree, and we're very conscious of the fact that, you know, unlike many other organizations, institutions, and so on, you know, we think in terms of generations and centuries, not just, oh gosh, what are we going to be doing next year? Yeah. And, you know, imposes a great, you know, huge responsibility on us. But it's, you know, it's such a privilege. I mean, I've always wanted to be involved in the Royal Parks. And when the opportunity to become chair came up, I mean, I absolutely, you know, did my best to prove myself to be the right person for it.
You get a uniform, the park keeper's uniform, or sort of, you know, like a sort of peak cap with some gold braid on it or anything. You have your own stick for the rubbish. Well, Lloyd, all I can say is, I mean, imagine a sort of gold threaded bag made by Royal Mail, especially if you'd...
No, rather stand there. I'm just in musty.
And my thanks to Lloyd Graceman for being such a great sport and a wonderful guest. Grinning Gibbons, centuries in the making, runs at Bonhams in London from 3rd to the 7th of August before moving to the Compton Verney Art Gallery, Warwickshire, in September, where the exhibition continues until next January. As the speedo of publication life trips another zero and we pass to the 400th edition of The Oldie Magazine, if you enjoyed this podcast, tell a friend. No, tell three. And if you'd like to engage further with The Oldie Magazine, visit theoldie.co.uk. Meanwhile, from me, Harry Bucknell, tucked away in Dorset, busy throwing off the chastity belts of lockdown, thank you for listening. And remember, go easy out there. It's not over yet. With editing by Steve Campen, this has been a Gamekeeper production for The Oldie. Ta-da, thank you.